my favorite quotations is from a French novelist named Léon Blois. And the quotation says, "There are places in the heart that do not yet exist. Pain must be in order that they be." And the idea of that quotation, of course, is that suffering expands our hearts and allows us to become more empathetic and to understand a lot more. I've often said as a counselor, I can understand people's craziest behavior because I've been there. It takes one to know one. But the idea, we've been talking about a lot of pain. I've been talking about a lot of pain for 7 weeks, about a lot of dysfunction, and a lot of statistics that mark us as the supposedly the highest advanced people in the world, but with these terrible problems of incest and alcohol addiction and drug addiction and disrupted family systems. Tonight we want to begin talking about what we can do about it. And more than anything tonight, I want to talk about the individual. As this system's work has gotten going, remember I said it began about 1950 or so. It's very new. It's very new, and a lot of experimentation has been done since its inception. And tonight I have with me again Terry Kellogg, who, in my opinion, is on the cutting edge of the kinds of things that can be done for healing people who have come out of compulsivity families or compulsive families or been set up for addiction or codependency or all the kinds of things that we've talked about. And Terry's going to come on a little bit later in the program and share with us the kind of work that is being done in really the process that he himself developed called the New Family Life Workshops. And I'll say some more about that, and Terry will say some more about that when he comes on. For the next 3 weeks now, we'll be talking about healing and recovery. And more than anything, finding that lost child within us, understanding the issues. Remember I said it's not a blame game. We're not going back to try to blame our parents. That's one of the beautiful things about the idea of the family system. You see that when you begin to understand that one person affects all the persons in the system, that it's circular, that the system works by feedback rather than cause and effect. It's not we blame daddy. My daddy came from a long line of, a multi-generational line of alcoholics. That's what we understand about dysfunctional families. They're multi-generational. So I'm not blaming my father. What I want to do is assign responsibility. See, I'm not saying my daddy was an alcoholic, so don't count on me for anything. Don't ask me to be responsible. In fact, when I was drinking, I used to say stuff like that. I remember being in a bar one night, looking over at a guy and saying, "Listen, man, I should have been a schizophrenic." You know, I'm sure the poor guy was thinking, "Geez, man, maybe you are." But I remember, you know, being very proud that I was just a totally screwed up alcoholic instead of a schizophrenic. And so the idea here is not to blame anybody, but to assign responsibility, to go back and try to understand how I was abused, how my feelings got stuck, what role I got stuck in back there, what role I'm still playing in my life right now, how that family system is still impacting my life at this red hot minute. I shared with you a few programs ago how I got in touch with some issues about money, how I had no boundaries about money. I came out of a family of scarcity. So I was being driven by, well, you know, if they want me to give a talk, just give a talk, because you got to save for a rainy day. There's never going to be enough. And I've really made some decisions about that, out of tracking that piece down. But there's far more serious kinds of pieces that need to be tracked down, pieces that affect the very substance of your being. You see, in one sense, it isn't that we lost our identity back there. It's that we never had an identity. It isn't that I lost a little person who didn't know how to love. I never saw the kind of love model that I think is fulfilling, self-actualizing love. The fact is that there was a person back there that really got frozen in his or her development. I had a woman in my office the other day. Her mother used to literally lock her in the closet. I had another guy I talked to. He used to get hung up on a coat rack. Now, I can't identify with that, but a lot of the other kinds of emotional neglect that I've talked about, I can, you know, happen to me, and I bet happen to a lot of you. I want to read you a poem. This is by Christopher Marlowe. This is the guy Buckminster Fuller quotes all the time. This is Buckminster Fuller, who did the geodesic dome, this great creative genius. He quotes this poem: "The greatest poem ever known is one all poets have outgrown. The poetry innate, untold, of being only 4 years old. Still young enough to be a part of nature's great impulsive heart, born comrade, a bird and bee, and unself-conscious as the tree, and yet with lovely reason skilled each day new paradise to build, a late explorer of each sense, without dismay, without pretense. In your unstrained, transparent eyes, there is no conscience, no surprise. Life's queer conundrums you accept, your strange divinity still kept. And life that sets all things in rhyme may make you poet too in time. But there were days, O tender elf, when you were poetry itself." You see, the tragedy, the crisis of our families is to have lost that little poet part of us all. Remember I read you from Saint-Exupéry the first night, that he looked at this child in the fourth class of the railroad car, and he saw this musician's face, and he says, "There's a little Mozart murdered." You see, Erik Erikson, on the, I think, the 50th anniversary or the 40th anniversary of Freud's death, said, "Freud's great legacy to us is to bring us a new ethical responsibility to childhood." Because Freud helped us to understand how that energy gets blocked, how people get fixated and form these ego defenses way back when, because the situations they're in are intolerable. See, thank God we have ego defenses. But Erikson said, it's an ethical responsibility to the child within myself, to my own children, to other people's children. Or I've heard Terry Kellogg say, it's a responsibility to the child in all of you. I've heard you say that you are an advocate, a child advocate. I've loved hearing you say that you're fighting for the child in every one of us, and that we're in an offender-protected society. You see, this little child, I feel sadness right now as I talk. I feel sadness. It's like we all know about this. There's some deep place that we all know about this. We all know about that little child that got lost and couldn't be spontaneous anymore and had to adapt. Remember, first night I talked about the private self and the public self, and that by the time you're in puberty, that public self has gotten much wider, and that by the time you're in adulthood, that public self is just very big and the private self is tiny. I couldn't work it out with my Russian doll, but I wished I could. If I got a doll that you open up and there's another doll, and you open it up and there's another doll, and it's 17 dolls inside that doll, and it goes down to a little bitty tiny doll. And it gets the idea across of these layers and layers and denials of the denials and avoidances and avoiding the avoidances, to where there's all these onion skins until finally you just don't know who you are. And you don't know what you want. And you don't know what to do. See, and that's the issue. And then at the core of us is this shame. I've talked about this shame. I want to read you. I got onto shame with the book called Mirror Mask by Sheldon Cope. It's a wonderful book. And this is what he says: shame is a learned piece of personal pathology, a kind of needless suffering to which children do not have to be subjected. But not just children, see. My shame dominated and controlled most of my life. That is, the part of me that wanted to hide and run away. See, shame is that feeling of eyes being on you when you're too little. Erik Erikson says, when you're too little to have eyes on you. It's developed in the second developmental stage. You're too little to have eyes on you. It's the sudden interruption of your experience. You have these expectations, and suddenly you can't trust your own eyes anymore. And so as a person gets shamed, and shaming arises out of the pathology of neurotic parents. When shamed, the child is expected to take care of the self-absorbed adults. Such a child may never learn that the natural order of things is quite the reverse. He or she is discouraged from ever realizing that it is the parent who is supposed to take care of the child. And in the work that's being done now, the work that Terry Kellogg is doing, what we're understanding is how many people get in these roles we talked about and are taking care of their parents, taking care of the system, so they never get to have their own reality. You never get to have your own reality. You never get to have your own feelings. Jacques Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, nature wants children to be children before they are men or women. If we deliberately depart from this order, we shall get premature fruits, which are neither ripe nor well-flavored, and which soon decay. We shall have youthful sages and grown-up children, who will then have other children and multi-generationally continue the shaming process. Now, the terrible thing about shame is that shame is a feeling, and like all feelings, it rises and falls. But if you get shamed over and over again, if you've got shame-based parents, let's say your parent is an addict and the other parent is a codependent, those are not people who love themselves or have any reality. So they're shame-based. They couldn't possibly teach you how to love yourself or love anybody else because they're already shame-based. I've said it 20 times in this series. How can you teach somebody to love themselves if you don't love yourself? How can I possibly teach my children how to do that? So just think back, any of you who are watching right now, did your parents love themselves? Did you see the telltale signs of self-love? That they cared for themselves? They made sure they got their needs met? They were happy because they got their needs met? And if they didn't, then you had modeled for you shame-based people who didn't know how to teach you how to love. They couldn't teach you what they didn't know, and you couldn't learn what wasn't there to learn. So you see, not only is the internalization of shame happening because you're getting shamed by your self-absorbed parents who can't handle your spontaneity, can't handle your instinctual drives, can't handle the kind of narcissistic needs that a little child has. But they were also modeling for us. And then we got our feelings shamed, so that when I was angry, I was told it was one of the seven deadly sins. When I was sad, I was called a ninny. If I was afraid, it was being a weenie. If I was joyous, there were still children starving in Latin America. So you couldn't be mad, you couldn't be glad, you couldn't be sad, you couldn't be afraid. Not much left in terms of the vital. You remember what functionality is? It's to be vitalized. It's spontaneity, not rigidity. Not having, remember, of emotions or energy, and if you can't have them, what do? You tense your muscles to stop them from coming. So we're uptights. We're in an uptight generation. So the healing is to get aware of how you were set up in your families, to get aware of how you got stuck back there, what role you're carrying, and what feelings are around that role. See, for me, my God, I was enraged. I would go into bars drunk and kick tables over with guys with tattoos, all of them, six or eight of them. You know, they frowned on that. And they frowned on me. It was very self-destructive. And this rage would come in. But sober, it was Gentle John. It was Gentle John, the helper, the one who was helping all others. And this rage, I still haven't gotten my rage out. It's not all out, I guarantee you. I mean, you can hear it sometimes. Some of you have come up and said, you're really mad tonight, John. Because there's rage in there. There's rage. The setups that my daddy was never there and that I was set up to be my brother's daddy and my mother's husband. And oh, my God. Children are supposed to be children! There was a time, O tender elf, when you were poetry itself. See, what happened? We all got waylaid. And so there's got to be a way to get back to that. So I've got to understand that very early on, now you can really understand it better when you think of severe abuse, that people dissociate. Remember I talked last week about a woman 35 years later remembering the sexual scenes? I had a client one time 48 years later. When she first described her family to me, it was wonderful, church-going people. I knew something was wrong. She was married to her fourth brutal alcoholic. She was totally codependent. The guy had set her up to whore for him. These were upper middle class people, too. And finally, one day, she just broke down and began to weep and told me that from 8 years old to 13 years old, she performed oral sex on her father. It took her 40 years to get back to those memories. Now, see, in one sense, God has given us these denial systems, what Freud called the ego defenses. And they're salvific. If that girl didn't know how to dissociate and block out those memories, no telling what would have happened to her. If I hadn't known how to cut off my feelings so I had no more expectations, my daddy couldn't disappoint me anymore because I had no more expectations. I didn't feel anything. There was no way not playing golf or not going fishing was going to cause me to lay there and cry till 2:30 in the morning. I just didn't feel about it, and I had no expectations anymore. You see, that's salvific when you have the ego defense. And the unconscious is very reluctant to give those up. It's like the gorilla that hits the ball 400 yards, takes out his putter and putts 400 yards. All it knows how to do is hit it 400 yards. Once the unconscious knows it's keeping you safe, it goes, now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, honey. You've survived, remember? Everything you've done up to now has worked. You're here. You're not dead. And so you see, breaking out of this delusional system, these ego defenses. See, some people can't even bear. I've had people just horrified at this series, at parts of this series that I'm talking about parents. And I'm challenging sacred cows. I'm saying, instead of focusing on honor thy mother and father, what about unless you become as little children? You shall not enter the kingdom. And honor means honesty and dignity and valuing. And children honor their parents by expressing anger. That shows that you've sired a human being and not a vegetable. So we need to correct that. And we need to quit denying it out of our own denial systems, because we've been set up to what? What? Here are some of the early primary ego defenses. Denial, very primitive. Once it gets set up, it functions unconsciously. Another one is repression. Another one is dissociation. So you dissociate from the memories. You don't have the memories anymore. You have all the feelings. They're encoded in your body, because remember, feelings are energy. Idealization. I work with a guy in Los Angeles, big, powerful arms. His father used to make him practice the trumpet for hours while all the other kids were playing. He's always had this thing in his back. He can't really use his arms because this guy has so much rage. But as we began to get him beating pillows and getting that anger out, his arms got all loose and he could begin to flow in his body. Because you see, and he idealized his father. He put his father on a pedestal. His father was a professor and his father was in the newspaper. He wanted to kill his father for being jailed, because his father wanted him to be the trumpet player that his father never was. You see how the father was using him for his own needs. That's what abuse is. It's to be used for someone else's needs. So awareness. Let me get you to do something right now. Just turn to the person next to you. Just turn it to the person next to you and get about an inch from them, or somebody. Get close to somebody. Get about an inch from them. Okay? And just stay there just for 15 seconds. As close as you can get to that person with your own boundaries. I don't want you violating your boundaries, okay? See, some of you, look at all the different boundaries in here, okay? All right, now move away. Now, did you smell anything? How many of you smelled anything? Honest to God, raise your hand. Okay, maybe 1% of you. Do it again, this time concentrate on smelling. Just do it again. Smell your neighbor. This isn't something we learned to do as kids, but try it. Okay, smell your neighbor. Now, how many of you smelled the second time around? Raise your hand. All right, look. Almost the whole audience. We ought to make a song out of that. We smell the second time around. Okay, what's the idea about that? The idea about that is awareness. Awareness. That people are smelling all the time. Not bad, but everybody smells. And you see, until you get aware, but notice that you can be unaware of something that is right there. Now, what I want you to hear is that you can be unaware of feelings that you've had for years that have been locked in there with your denials and the delusional systems that got set up. Remember I said in the first program, the crisis of the family is a crisis of untruth. It's a crisis of not telling the truth. It's a crisis of discipline, a way we discipline. But it's that delusional system which is the lie. Now, in order to get well, you've got to come out of that. The way out is through. There's an old Gestalt story of a man locked in a cave and it's dark. And there's a light up there and he keeps scratching the wall trying to get to the light. And he dies. And they roll this rock away. And there's this big tunnel in the cave. See, the tunnel was in the darkness. So the healing process is one where you have to go into the darkness. You have to go in descent into the maelstrom. You have to go into the depth. You have to embrace the feelings. We have to be willing to risk. See, with somebody like me, to be vulnerable is so scary out of my shame. Because I have so much shame. That shame got interiorized. And then it literally controls my life. Because, you see, shame is that unexpected interruption. So I don't even trust my senses anymore. Think I trust you? How can I trust you if I don't even trust my own eyes? So you see, shame breaks the interpersonal bond. It breaks the interpersonal bond. So I walk around hiding. See, remember, shame is about hiding. And then the most terrible thing that happens with it is that not only do I hide from you, but I hide from myself. At a certain point, I can't ever look at myself because I've been hiding so long, creating this false self, this mask, this face to meet the faces that I meet, this sociocultural mask, these sex roles, these roles, or whatever. Now, one of the important things in working out that shame is that, because shame is about feeling worthless, shame is as different from guilt. Guilt is I made mistakes, I've gotten some things wrong, I violated my own conscience, I made mistakes, but I can do something about it. Guilt is I am a mistake. Guilt is what the Gouldings call a third degree impasse. It's the self against the self. And it's so primitive even that you almost feel like you've always been that way. You've always been that way. That's what an internalized feeling is. I've always been this way. And so the working out of shame. Now, I want to talk to you tonight about coming out, because all compulsivities are based on shame, in my opinion. All life-damaging compulsivities. Out of my shame, what? I go drink something and I feel good. I don't have the shame anymore. Or you go have sex and you feel good and have somebody admiring you and you don't have shame anymore. Or you eat Bluebell cookies and cream, half gallon of it, and you don't have that feeling anymore. And then when you finish, the mind starts going, oh my God, look at what I've done. And then guess what? More shame. See, so it's like a squirrel cage. There's no way out. The only way out is through. The only way out is to go into it. Now, 12-step programs are based on the belief that I'm powerless and my life has become unmanageable. And I want people to hear that there are Families Anonymous 12-step programs, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Alcohol Anonymous, Emotional Anonymous. They're all over these programs. Sex Addicts Anonymous. These programs are growing. Why? Because they work. Now, Terry's going to talk tonight about they don't work all alone. They stop the behaviors. And then once a certain kind of treatment is set up and people work through the setups for the addictions, which were salvific in the beginning, but are like the gorilla that hit the golf ball 400 yards when they putt. They don't work now. You see, it worked great. I used to pout and my mother would indulge me. I'd pout, I wouldn't talk to her. And she'd say, well, you know, after about a day and a half, she'd want to go to a show. Then I met this girl in the eighth grade and I really fell for her. And on the second, you know, and then she started, I saw her talking to another boy one day. So I gave her the heavy pout. And she ditched me. See, what had worked beautifully didn't work anymore. So my not feeling my feelings, my saying, I'm not going to feel anything in this system anymore. 25 years later, 30 years later, people may be going, you know, what do you want? Who are you anyway? Who are you in there? And so it doesn't work anymore. And finally, you see, that false self, that shame-based self crashes. I'm powerless over Bluebell ice cream. My life's become unmanageable. And hey, a lot of people's lives are unmanageable over Bluebell ice cream. They don't think they're unmanageable. Or alcohol, or sex, or whatever the addiction is, work. Then I believe something greater than myself. Well, you know there's something greater than yourself. It's the addiction. Believe something greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Then I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand her, him, them, whoever. What's beautiful about that is the beginning of the restoration of the interpersonal bond. You see, that bond was broken, and so you just take a leap. Of course, a person in a 12-step program has taken another leap, too, the belief that they have the right to depend on somebody. Because, you see, as a shame-based person, I'm hiding. I don't have a right to depend on anybody. I didn't get my dependency needs met. That's the most terrible part of shame. And so in that 12-step program, I remember when I first went to AA, and I thought they had set it up. I won a big book that night, and I thought everybody had gotten together, 140 people had gotten together and said, let's let this freaky character win a big book tonight. That's how egocentric I was in that false self, that grandiose self. See, if you're shame-based, man, you got to have something to go on with. That's where the grandiosity comes from. Then the fourth step is in a 12-step program. I'm just talking about 12-step programs in general. Is I took a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. That is, I really began to look at where I was blocked. That's what I see that inventory as, the fear, the block, that I was afraid to come out. I was hiding all the time. I was hiding. I was hiding behind my shame. I was always had to be perfect. I made straight A's. I was the valedictorian. I was the captain of the football team. I had all that kind of stuff. And that was all a way to keep people away from me. In high school, I had 27 pair of tailor-made pants. That's a way to, see, put it all on the outside so you can't see the inside. One time, shortly after I was sobering up, I was driving along one day. I think I've told some of you this story. I was in a yellow Oldsmobile convertible. I had alligator shoes on, and I was about 6 months sober. I was figuring out how much I was worth. My body was worth. I had a $125 suit on. I had a $600 diamond ring. I had these alligator shoes. I came to find out that I was worth $927. And then it dawned on me. I had these Fruit of the Loom shorts on. With holes in them. Worth about 2 cents. You know, when somebody really have to go far to pay 2 cents for these. See, it was all on the outside. Everything was on the outside. The inside of me was shame-based, riddled with shame. I didn't care what anyone thought about the inside. It was the outside. Be perfect and perfectionism and all that's a cover-up. So that program then, 12-step program's got these steps that allow you, this fourth step, to really take an inventory and to see the exact nature of your wrongs, and then again to trust somebody, to go tell somebody, yourself, tell yourself and another human being in this higher power the exact nature of your wrongs and ask them to be removed. That's hope. See, for a shame-based person, I am a mistake. How could anything be removed? So these 12-step programs, the group and the program takes you from shame to guilt. Guilt is, I made a mistake, I can do something about it. And then the steps are about, okay, let's get all the people that I've really harmed, because I did a lot of shameful things. See, if you don't have any shame, you do shameful things. I remember somebody telling me one night, don't you have any shame? Answer was no. I'm dissociated from it a long time ago. I don't have any shame. I don't feel anything. So making amends then, I make amends, except where to do so would harm me. And that takes me through step 9. Then step 10 is what I call the restoration of the sociocultural ego. That isn't what they call it, but that's what I call it. What that step is about is, see, when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Well, you got to have some pretty good internal structure. Otherwise, you see, a shame-based person can't ever make a mistake. I could never let you see me make a mistake, for God's sake. because that would be too shameful, and the shame spiral would start if you saw me make a mistake. So I don't ever make a mistake. Well, when wrong promptly admitted is just to have a strong enough ego that I'm human. Like all humans, I make mistakes. I'm a perfect human. And as a perfect human, I make mistakes. See, I got this hammer at home. It's got burnt marks in it. It's a perfect hammer. It does just what a hammer's supposed to do, even though it's got burnt marks in it. It's a perfect hammer. We as an organism are perfect. We have all we need. It just got waylaid back there. Now, next week, I'm going to talk about steps 11 and 12, which are the spiritual steps, because you got to have a fairly good coping to be able to transcend ego. You got to have an ego to transcend. In order to go to higher power and higher consciousness and spiritual awakening. And hey, I didn't say this last week, but I see a lot of people in religion who use groups like codependency. That is, I give my reality, my feelings, needs, and wants to some group that tells me what to do. I never do anything. I don't have any reality of my own at all. So I've got to have a reality in order to be able to give it. In order to be able to transcend, in order to be able to come to this place where I can transcend my own reality. So I see the 12-step programs as the greatest healing phenomena of maybe all time. That is, that they maintain, as Terry Kellogg said last week, people who are in incurable addictions and who then can have very functional and wonderful lives by using these programs and the support groups in the process of healing. Well, I'm going to call Terry up right now. Welcome again. Terry Kellogg. Have a seat. I hope you had a good week since I've seen you. Lad,
wonderful.
Great. To those that did not see Terry last week, I want to just briefly introduce Terry Kellogg again. He is a consultant all over the country. In areas of compulsivity. He started some of the first compulsivity clinics, which dealt with the issues that we've been talking about, and showed how compulsivity was rooted in family systems. And currently, we here in Houston have been working with Terry at the Center for Recovering Families, putting on new life family workshops, which are precisely ways to go back and work through those setups for addiction. And that's basically what I'd like you to talk about tonight, if you have a mind to.
Okay. First of all, I think recovery is something that we're all seeking, but it's really a process and not an event. And we want a fix sometimes instead of recovery, so we go to a workshop looking for that fix. We can find a high sometimes, but very seldom is it really a fix. You know, recovery has to be seen in terms of the rest of our life as a process. The other part about recovery, though, is that nothing changes till it becomes real. I think you say it when you talk about how you have to go into the reality to be able to deal with it. Scott Peck in The Road Less Traveled said, the only path away from our suffering is to embrace our suffering. But for some of us, the families we came from don't allow us to make it real. Some of us came from sexually abusive families where our defense for that, as you said, is dissociation, memory loss, spacing out. Being a spider in a spider web, you know, while it's happening, floating around the room. So how do we remember that? Well, for that kind of situation, of course, the feelings can bring us to the memory, trusting and embracing the feelings. Our bodies won't forget what's happened to us, and our feelings are physical and emotional. So kind of following the path of our feelings and trusting that reality, looking at what we're doing. We all have responses to abuse and violence and enmeshment. We have to look at those responses, and they'll give us the message. So I think that recovery involves making those things real. Now, some of us came from families where we had Saint Mom and Dad, too. I don't know if, you know.
A little bit, talked about that.
Okay, okay. And with Saint Mom and Dad, that's a denial system. The first family I worked with in this field was Saint Mom and Dad. And there were five kids, four chemically dependent, one suicide. And I thought, what's going on here? What's happened to family systems? You know, these parents are wonderful. And all three kids that I worked with said they were saints. But it was a total feeling reality denial system. No fighting, no anger. Mom and Dad love each other, don't we, Mom? You know, and a very codependent and enmeshed relationship where there wasn't love. It looked like love, but it was guilt disguised as love. See, I can love you in a way that you have to do then what I want you to do. That's not love, that's guilting you, because I'm so good. The better I am, the more you'll have to please me or be like me. See, and if I love you, I'm going to help you become the person that you are. So I think that, in fact, guilt is the veneer of codependency. Shame empowers addiction, but the veneer of the addiction of codependency is guilt. And you sort of peel off that layer of guilt and you find all the anger about being used and not being ourselves, but the guilt even keeps us from the anger. The clinic process is a combination of processes. It's what we've learned about addiction, what we've learned about feelings, and what we've learned about family systems blended together in a short-term, very intensive process that is a beginning and not an end to recovery. I've been doing them for about 4 years, and I'm finding out that there's two processes within the clinic process that are important. One is the grief process. See, until we can grieve what's lost, we can't go on to what's new. And I don't care if it's the worst marriage in the world and you're so relieved to get rid of the SOB or whatever, there's still the loss of what you wanted it to be, the loss of the dreams of the marriage, the loss of the role of the marriage, or maybe the loss of the 17 minutes of good times in the 18 years of marriage or something, but there's always a loss that you have to grieve. The loss of our childhood, the loss of our integrity, the loss of our space, of boundaries, physical, emotional, sexual, intellectual. And part of grieving is to have the feelings in through the stages of the grief process. We go through the denial and the bargaining and the sadness and the anger. But once we get through that, we get acceptance and serenity, and then we go on to new relationships in life. But the first 3.5 days of the program are, I call it a forgiveness process. And that's kind of strange because a lot of us have been listening to the series. You know, sometimes we get mad. We say, you know, it's all about parents now. That's blame. And today you described, or tonight you described responsibility. And I love that. I love the term of giving responsibility so we can take responsibility. But I'll even go one step further. I think that real healing is forgiveness. And at your forbearance, I'll go through the stages of forgiveness.
Please do. Well, just one thing I was going to say is I've heard you say this too, that men, and I just want to say this in our culture, the stereotypes and the roles are, a lot of men are very frightened of therapy or frightened mm-hmm. of the process. We're taught not to cry. See, we're taught not to grieve. And so often, that's what I think keeps men away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add that mm-hmm. because it is a grief process. It's a saying goodbye, and there's a healing that comes with that.
That's really true. There's cultural and family messages about feelings that really make us afraid of therapy and afraid of feelings and afraid of the responses in us, afraid of coming alive. Men are taught not to cry. But women are taught not to be angry, and they still do a better job of being angry than men do. So, and we have this image that men can be angry, but what do? You talked about pouting. I survived by pouting in my family. You know, every time I pouted and didn't talk to my dad when he was mad, he'd never be mad at me. He'd be too afraid, because I wouldn't talk to him for 3 days. I'd hide in a closet for 3 hours after he'd yell, and then I wouldn't talk to him. So I learned passive aggressiveness. See, I learned to hide my anger and shut down. Then Gretchen would get mad at me. I wouldn't talk to her for 3 days. The relationship wasn't going well at those times. And I call that passive aggressive. And passive aggressive is like a big dog with its paws on your shoulders, licking your face and peeing on your leg at the same time.
That's beautiful.
And men are.
I know the dog.
Go ahead. Hair giant. And that as men, I think that we are afraid of our feelings, but it's killing us. We die 8 years earlier than women, and I don't think it's just work. I believe it's also about our inability to express our feelings. That's our codependency. That's our style. Protectorship and denial of feelings. Let's all, have that image of the strong, silent type that can take care of any situation and not feel anything through the situation. And it is killing us. It's not just the working all the time or the worrying all the time. It's the feelings. So, back to the forgiveness process. The first stage of a forgiveness process is to recognize there was a wrong done to us. And as you've been saying in the series, The whole dysfunction of families is not dysfunction. It's not problems. We all have problems. We come from a dysfunctional family when we deny the problem. The problem's impact on our lives. Part of the problem. Our feelings about the problem. Any denial keeps the problem from becoming something that the family can go through. Some of the healthiest families I work with are alcoholic families, and sometimes even where the alcoholism is active. But they're talking about their feelings, and there's some recovery going on with some members of the family. There's discussion. Some of the sickest families look wonderful. There's never any problems in those families. Everything just looks right until someone becomes anorectic, or someone commits suicide, or the family just falls apart and explodes, or there's a divorce, you know, and it just falls apart. But, you know, so how the family looks doesn't reflect the depth of the problem or the pathology. It's really the ability to talk about problems that is recovery, I think. So that's the first stage, recognizing there are wrongs done to us. And you said, honor thy father and mother. And we protect parents. And when we protect them, we neglect them. Now, how can you have a relationship with someone who's hurt you that you never got to say you hurt me to anybody? You had to pretend that it never happened. You wouldn't want to stay away from them. That's what old people are suffering from in our society.
That's beautiful. I love that.
And the next stage is to recognize that we had feelings about the problem. Just recognizing. We don't have to feel them yet. Just, yeah, I had feelings about the fact that my mom made me her husband when I was 9 years old. You know, that I had to talk about her pain. She cried on my shoulder. I cleaned the cupboards when she was gone so she'd feel better when she came home. I was the one that affirmed her whether she looked nice. And I was parenting her or espousing her. I became the husband. Now, she was my first client. I was doing therapy. I was 9 years old, and I already had a caseload. And I, you know, I've called that emotional incest. She calls that career development. So we have, you know, we talk about this now, and we, you know, so just to recognize that I had feelings about that was important, because I didn't want to have feelings, because I wanted to protect my mom. I loved my mom. I wanted to protect her. I saw her beaten by my father. You know, I didn't want to beat her with my anger. I got married, and I'd start to beat Gretchen. I'd start to not beat her physically, but with my anger. I'd put her down, or I'd cut her off, or something. And so it was those feelings that I wasn't recognizing that were ruining my relationships with others and myself. So just to recognize that I had the anger, the pain, the fear. And a lot of us somatize our feelings. You know, we make them into headaches, tight stomachs, muscle tremors, illnesses. And I think that that's probably a lot of what's killing us. You know, people die of diseases of lifestyle that are about stress and feelings and the inability to express those realities. And so we take, you know, drugs, aspirin for our headaches, something for our stomach, something for the muscle tremor. You know, we try to fix our depression through drugs, and drugs can't do it. So just the recognition that feelings are important, and we get value from our feelings. You know, that our feelings give us gifts. We've talked about shame. See, we do need some shame, you know, and the thing that we said before about, like, you need enough shame to keep from going to the supermarket naked. You need shame so that you don't know, so that you know that you're not God, that we can't do anything. You know, that there are bad people things that people can do.
Yeah, that's such a good point. You talk about making your feelings your friends.
Yes.
And say some more about that. I mean,
well, our feelings are our guides. They tell us, you know, they keep us connected to who we are, to what's happened to us, to where we're going. They're our guideposts to reality and to life. They give us the chance for relationship. And that fear gives us wisdom. See, absence of fear is delusion. Evil Knievelish kind of activities that, you know, I'll jump the Grand Canyon on my tricycle to prove I'm not afraid. That doesn't prove I'm not afraid. That proves there's something missing upstairs.
Yeah.
You know, or we get so controlled by the fear that we're life's wallflowers. We won't get out and dance. You know, we're afraid people will laugh at us or people will reject us. And then where would we end up if we've rejected? Right back on the wall. We haven't lost a thing. We might even enjoy the trip out. You know, but we, you know, or we'll sprain an ankle. See, when I go to a dance, two of the three usually happen. Even Gretchen turns me down, and I finally
found his wife.
Yeah, right. And I finally found out that even if Gretchen's turning me down, and I can go out and dance, you know, anonymously, and even if people laugh, they're having fun, and I'm having fun. So it's like just accepting the fear and not doing the things that are going to incorporate loss of my life or limb. But just maybe a loss of face once in a while isn't so bad. I can live with that, so I'll take the risks that I need to experience life. And so we need our fear because it's a guide to wisdom. We need our anger because it's change and strength.
And you talked about what Ralph Nader did with his anger.
Oh, he's changed the lives of hundreds of millions of people. Well, look what the Incredible Hulk does.
Yeah.
I mean, he becomes a green weightlifter. Right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And he makes change, and that's how our anger works.
That's beautiful.
And we need our sadness because it's healing, it's our vulnerability, and it's our intimacy, and it's our empathy with others, and it's our grieving process. And those are gifts. Those aren't bad things. We need our guilt because it's our conscience. It's our conscience formation. You know, it's if I say something to hurt you, I have a feeling about that. I know I've done that, and I can rectify. I can talk about, you know, and when I lose that conscience formation, then I don't see other people's pain as real, and that's where I think we get into dealing with our kids. We don't have enough guilt sometimes about how we treat our kids. Not real guilt. We have shame about it. We think we're bad parents. We don't just see. We made mistakes. We have feelings about it, and we can rectify this. And we need the shame to keep from thinking that we're God and we can do anything. So
in the process, then, the next step is you acknowledge the feelings and then...
Okay, recognize me, then embracing the feelings. We have to make them as big as they are. See, I think that therapy is a process of making the covert explicit. And that's true of the system, but it's also true of the feelings. When we can acknowledge and embrace the feelings within us, then we're embracing ourselves, because our feelings are a part of our reality. And when we're walking around without our feelings, we don't have our reality. Or when we're obsessing and acting out our feelings, or talking about our pain in the supermarket lane, where there's no boundaries, then our reality is enmeshed and disseminated out all over the place, and we don't have it either. So I think that just the embracing of our feelings and letting our feelings be there.
And especially you talk about the original pain where those roles got set up,
right.
The feelings around those,
yes.
Which are a release.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the subsequent pain that we have is merely a reenactment. In fact, if I'm a victim of neglect, abuse, guilting, excessive guilting, violence, what I'll probably do is find some place where I can have my feelings about that. So I might get into a relationship with someone that victimizes me, so then I don't feel so crazy because I've got the feelings and I've got the event. But that event is just a secondary event to give me the feelings so I don't feel crazy. The event I have to deal with is what happened originally to give me those feelings. And subsequently, I'll just reenact and reenact so I can continue feeling the same way and not have to be so crazy.
Yeah.
So embracing the feelings gives us our reality. The next stage is the important one, I think. It's where we learn to share our feelings with others. See, when I can talk to you about the pain of my child, you can talk to me about the pain of your childhood. And I can talk to you about the pain of my codependency and addictiveness, and you can talk about your alcoholism. What we're doing is we're getting closer. We're having a relationship. We're loving each other. And we feel closer when we talk about those things. See, and if I express to you, you know, I can entertain, you know, with what happened to me in my childhood, but when I tell you, you know, and you said that here, it hurt. And how many of you felt closer to John when he said, I'm feeling the sadness right now? You know, how many of you felt closer to him at that moment than you did the previous few weeks? See, it's that he was loving us. He's loving us with the sharing of his reality. That's what love is. It's the act. It's an act. It's an action of sharing who we are, our reality, with another person. And it's our feeling reality that brings people closer in. So I think that's part of the healing. Now, sometimes we share it with the person that hurt us. But I recommend a phrase called a judicious evaluation. Sometimes they'll hurt us more. Sometimes they'll deny our reality. Sometimes they'll have a heart attack and die the next day to punish us. Which,
so you don't
that's
go
extreme.
Rushing home
yeah.
right now.
No, that's,
and,
that's extreme, but yeah, you don't go rushing home.
And you do a lot of it symbolically by acting it out.
Role playing. Mm-hmm. Sculpting it, imaging it. Some people recommend writing it. I think that's a clarification, not really dealing with the feeling itself.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the therapeutic process to me of learning to share the feelings with others, and whether it gets directly shared with the person that hurt us or not. I find that a client that wants to share it with the person and that they insist on that right away, they really want to do it to fix the other person. They want to change that person.
Yeah, I can really identify with that.
And that it's well, there's something about therapists wanting to change the world
yeah,
and other people,
right.
I suppose, and
go
all
fix
those,
the family.
You know, right. That's, yeah. It's kind of like fixing our families too. The next stage then is after we share the feelings, then we have to make a decision of what we're going to do with the relationship. And so, if you hurt me, And I can talk about the feelings, but I have to decide sometime of what, how it's going to affect the relationship. That's just a natural process of protecting myself, having boundaries, and me being in charge of what happens to me. And so the decision about relationship sometimes is one that the hurt isn't so big that it will affect the relationship so much. And so you say, no, I still love the person. I can trust the person most of the time. Sometimes the hurt is so big that we have to have some separation time. Usually what we need, though, is detachment rather than separation. And detachment is where we can be around the person but not have our reality pulled away from us. We don't have to carry their pathology or always react to their problems or fix or feel crazy because they're denying something. That's detachment. And I think that one of the things that I did with my own family was I worked this process. I had my feelings. I shared my feelings. I even shared a lot of it with them. And then I had that decision to make. Well, I couldn't make it. And I realized that a decision not to decide that was a decision. And that it was a process. And I was trying to force it into an event. Eventually, my decision was to enjoy who they were. And I've been doing that more now. And they still fight sometimes. And they still, you know, do things that I don't like and I have feelings about. But I can enjoy who they are now.
Yeah, I really want people to hear that, because when we talk about the setups, it isn't that you have to lose your family out of it. It's a process of forgiveness.
Yes.
And completing the past and getting the resentments finished.
Right.
Okay. Here we're 1 minute. I just want to tell people that we are doing this process at the Center for Recovering Families about 6 times a year here in Houston, and you're doing it in some other places, but...
Right. Let me finish the last stage then.
Okay.
After we've done that, we get a sense of acceptance and serenity about the hurt and about the relationship. And that doesn't mean we don't have feelings about it. It means that it no longer controls our reality. And that's the therapy process. That's the first part of the clinic. After that, we need an aftercare plan, a life plan, 12-step programs, networking, support.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I sure do thank you for being here and for sharing that. I really think that's one of the cutting-edge, real applications of family systems and how we can understand them to bring ourselves to completion. So thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Well, great. I just wanted to close by following up what Terry said. You know, blessed are they that mourn, for they will be comforted. And I think we've lost that sense of grieving. To grieve well is to live well. The poet said, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. Nor all thy piety nor wit can lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. The childhood is over with. My daddy is gone. I have to grieve that lost childhood. I can never have that again. And there's a hole in me that nothing can fill. I've heard you say that so beautifully. It has to be healed. And in the grieving is the healing, because the end of grieving is to be born again. The end of grieving is to complete the past. You heard me say that you're not in any other relationships if you haven't healed those source relationships. I want to quote one other thing in closing. I found this last summer, if I could get a quick close-up on it, an artist. I was walking down a side street in London, and I saw this, and I thought of Albert Camus. He said, in the midst of winter, I found within me an invincible summer. Do you see the red chairs in the midst of winter? The red chairs, that there is within us this power and this spirit, the power of those feelings, that out of the suffering and the pain comes the strength. If we can just understand that that's what it's about. One other quotation, nothing else matters half so much, this person says, but to reassure one another, to answer each other, everyone has inside of him, what shall I call it, a piece of good news.
Thank you.